This is UNISA Radio, the African voice is all about you. Speaking with me live, I'm talking to Angelina, who's going to tell us more about energy and climate with me, Godfrey Madibane. And thank you so much for joining us. If you've just tuned in, our station is radio.unisa.ac.za. You can Google us there. And on the landing page, when you get there, just look for any player that you can use. We're also available on mobile. You can go to Google Store, look for us there, just say UNISA Radio, download the app and listen to us there. On Facebook page, it's facebook.com/UNISA Radio. At Twitter, it's @UNISA Radio. And on YouTube, just type UNISA Radio and look for the logo. Now, Angelina, thank you so much for joining us on the line all the way from the United States. Before I just briefly give the listeners who you are, can you do that? Just briefly tell us who you are without me having to interrupt your awesome introduction.
Thank you so much, Godfrey, and it's a pleasure to be here. And as I had told you, energy for me is not a job, it's not work, it's a passion and a calling. And from very early on, I decided that if you wanted to have a social impact, you needed to tackle the issue of energy, whether it's energy poverty, like in some of the sub-Saharan countries. And I grew up in East Africa, Tanzania, and traveled around the continent quite a bit. So I'm aware of the issues related to energy and what opportunities that presents, as well as the challenges we need to overcome. I'm also originally from Eastern Europe, so having experienced Chernobyl up close and personal, you're keenly aware that pollution does not respect national boundaries. And air pollution, water pollution, land pollution can spread. Who bears the responsibility? And do we have a responsibility to future generations to ensure that we provide a safe resource of energy that is available to all and that is indeed sustainable? And then the issue of climate change, energy and transportation have a huge impact on climate change. And that is one of the most important topics of our generation. How are we going to ensure that we stay below the 2 degrees Celsius increase so that we don't have a catastrophe? We all have one planet. We need a plan B for that planet, and that's really hard to do. So we need to make sure we're all pulling together.
You know, Angelina, let's talk about jobs. We know the energy industry is changing with the growth of renewable energy technologies, and the changes this requires is in the way we manage generation, transmission, and distribution of energy. What would you advise a university student today to focus on in order to prepare for the energy jobs of tomorrow?
It is an incredible opportunity for engineering students who are in university right now. I actually work pretty closely with the universities here in California as well. And I was just at the University of California, Irvine on Friday, where they unveiled the first solar-powered hydrogen generator, which was feeding the hydrogen into their microgrid, providing a storage for the renewable technology. So as we move forward into tackling climate change and the new paradigm shift for energy, what has emerged as a very interesting fact is that renewables now are our cheapest cost resource. So as we develop more and more renewables, they're going to be taking over the generation that fossil plants provide, which means we all know renewables are intermittent. The sun doesn't shine all the time, even though there's plenty of it, and the wind doesn't blow all the time, even though there's plenty of it. So even though it's highly predictable, it is intermittent, we need to focus on storage. So the storage technologies and the flexible technologies that are going to be able to respond very quickly to the changing patterns of solar and wind are going to open the door for making sure that we transition to a carbon-free energy system. And we can take it a step further, which is really even more exciting for students, is those renewable energies can provide the fuels that are going to power the transportation sector of the future, because transport accounts for about 40% of greenhouse gas emissions. So electrifying the transportation sector, whether it's with electric vehicles or whether it's with fuel cells or whether it's directly with combustion of hydrogen in buses, which is what the Institute of Technology in Buenos Aires, Argentina is doing, with the students leading the charge of where they're allowing buses in Buenos Aires to be retrofitted and run on hydrogen that the university produces. And they have a partnership with Daimler Chrysler to do that for the mass transit. So university students are on the cutting edge. They have an incredible opportunity. Like, the information technology changed our world. The energy technology is the next wave, because it allows us to incorporate information technologies, empower the customer, and create new flexible resources on a microgrid level that interconnects to a larger grid, and that allows you to have complete freedom in operating a very sophisticated new energy system. And it's an incredible opportunity.
Lovely. Let's talk more about your work. You sit on the board of the California Independent System Operator. Could you share with us what role the system operator plays in the delivery of energy?
The independent system operator is the grid operator. So we operate the grid of California, which is one of the largest networks in the United States, certainly the largest on the West Coast. So we deliver energy and we transport it to the state. We interconnect, we run the energy markets as well, and we interconnect the resources. There's a very interesting app that you and your listeners can download, which is CAISO, California ISO, today. And you can see in real time the resources that are powering the grid, how much renewables is on the grid, and what it costs, and where the resources are, at what time, and what the predictions are, and then download the whole report for the day, which is completely transparent. So we follow the state law, which requires us to incorporate 50% renewables by 2030. But keep in mind that it's actually a lot more than 50%, because as part of California's portfolio, we do not count large hydropower. And we also do not count rooftop solar, which is at least another 15 to 20% on top of the 50%. So California is going to be predominantly operating a grid powered by renewables on a very large scale. And this we see as an incredible opportunity for innovation, for incorporating new technologies. It is the Silicon Valley for renewable technologies right now. And it is incredibly exciting to see companies like Apple, for instance, building their new building, which is 100% renewable energy powered and has enough storage and will be charging their vehicles as well. And they've embraced it as a solution, not only because it's cutting edge and it's the right thing to do for the environment, but because these technologies have come down in cost to where it makes them smart on a business level as a solution for any company. And that's why you see companies like MidAmerican, which is in the middle of Iowa, powering that region with 100% wind for the future. They're planning to do it. They're at about 80% now, but they can boldly state that they'll be going to 100% renewable because they have an integrated market. They've got the customers who want it, and it's cheaper than doing it with any other alternative. So they're not raising prices, they're not raising taxes, and they're providing a resource which people like.
As someone who's responsible for ensuring the reliable delivery of electricity to businesses and households, can you talk about the challenges that renewable energy poses for you?
Well, of course, there's challenges, but there's also opportunities for innovation and for getting better and for technological solutions. So initially, grid operators might say, well, you know, renewables are a little bit more intermittent. It's going to be difficult to integrate them into the grid. We like steady 24/7 power because there's no operational challenges. But if you've got a weather forecast on your forecaster on your team telling you pretty precisely what the weather is, so you can forecast how much renewables you're going to have, and if you, of course, have other resources on the grid that provide you that stable baseload power, and you've got new players coming into the market, such as third-party aggregators who can aggregate storage resources and energy efficiency. And energy efficiency, of course, is your lowest cost resource. So capturing any efficiencies available is the first step that we should all be taking. And dispatching it into the grid depending on timing, whether you've got over generation, the storage technologies can provide a sync and you can charge them for almost free. And then when you need additional power during some parts of the day or some instances because there's a cloud cover or the wind suddenly drops, then you could dispatch these distributed storage resources very quickly too. So what we're also seeing on the distribution grid and having a lot of distributed generation along with the solar generation is that we're seeing a more resilient grid, because the power is typically here and it is at the load, which is also very important. And even though it is intermittent, as I said, renewable energy is highly predictable. And what we've also noticed over the last few years, where we've had a very heavy drought in California, the increase in solar generation, which has been exponential, has actually alleviated the shortage of some of that hydro resource, and we were able to operate the grid reliably. So having grid resources, strengthening the transmission system, and making sure that you're beefing up the networks allows you to incorporate more renewables. But to get to the 100%, we really need to focus on the storage and flexible resources. That's the next frontier.
Have you in California changed the way you approach your job to accommodate a higher penetration of renewables in your energy mix?
That has now become the norm. We're not doubting anymore whether we have to incorporate the renewables or whether that's optional. It's something that we have to do. And I think the new generation of grid operators are now seeing that this is something they can work with. And they know the tools that they need and the roles that all of the resources have to play as they join the grid. Everybody has to be a good grid citizen and do their part to keep the grid stable so that the power can be delivered. But it is something that is doable. And if you plan for it and if you have a long-term view and a vision, yes, it's difficult, but the alternative of not doing anything is much more difficult, in fact, catastrophic. So we have a solution. We have the technology. Some of them are cheaper. Some of them are more costly. We need to drive some new markets in terms of technological breakthroughs for control as well as for storage. But we know what we need to do. And we know that there's a silver lining and a light at the end of the tunnel. And we can tackle this problem if we work together in a sustained fashion and push forward. And the jobs are there. Like you mentioned, jobs. I'll just tell you that right now, the solar industry in California employs more people than the three large utilities combined.
Sure.
And it's good jobs.
Yeah, nah. Now, you are also a founder of the Renewables 100 Policy Institute, which seeks to map a course to 100% reliable on renewable energy. Do you think 100% reliable on renewables is a realistic goal, given the current state of technology and that some of the challenges you've just discussed?
Yes, we started the Renewables 100 Policy Institute because, you know, as you transition to a cleaner environment, you need to have bold goals. And having a goal of 30%, 40%, maybe 50% and incrementally going up is good, but having a long-term vision is better. And now 100% is being embraced by many people. And in fact, many regions are living on 100% renewable energy with today's technology. Yes, we can do it. In the electricity sector, we can absolutely do it. The problem is going to be going to 100% renewable energy in the transportation sector and the industrial sector as well. That is where we need to have innovation. That's where we need to have hydrogen that powers the fuel cells, new battery technologies, new storage technologies, new creative, whether it's methanization, fuels that are going to be able to power industry and transportation as well. I think it can be done. Some of our colleagues in Europe are working towards that as well. They've showed the path how that can be achieved.
Yeah.
Yes, it's expensive. But what we've seen is renewables were expensive 10 years ago, and costs have dropped up by over 90% to where now they're the cheapest alternative. So certainly the same can happen in the fuel sector, we hope as well.
What communities in California have the highest dependence on renewable energy, and how did they arrive at this point?
Well, what is also interesting is that in California, we are seeing the creation of a new set of utilities, which is the community aggregators, the CCA, the community choice aggregators, where some communities are basically saying, whether it's Lancaster, whether it's Sonoma, whether it's actually San Diego officially announced that they're going to 100% renewables. The city of LA is studying going to 100% renewables. So there's certainly a domino effect of 100% renewable energy goals throughout California, but the CCAs are specifically targeted towards customers who want to have higher percentages of renewable energy than what the grid provides right now. They want to go beyond 50%. They want to go 60, 80, 100% and have the choice to purchase it and with their money actually vote for the creation of new power plants. Some of the larger players you mentioned, Google in some of their facilities says, we're going to co-locate renewable energy plants together with our facilities and we want to make sure that we're building new renewables as we grow our business as well. General Motors announced that they're going to be going 100% with their facilities. Apple has announced that they're going to be going to 100% on their facilities worldwide, including their suppliers. So it's actually an avalanche effect where business is stepping up and taking responsibility because they see it is important for people to have an environment they can live in and play in and grow their families and have good jobs and have them locally. Everybody wins. So why not do it and work towards that future? So we see this happening. We see that it's almost a grassroots movement. It's grounds up where customers are saying, we want this. We want control. We want the solar. We want the storage. We want the electric vehicle. We want that Tesla in our garage. And if you don't allow us to do it, who knows what the next step will be? The next step might be we'll disconnect from the grid and we'll do it on our own because we have the technologies to do it now. So we as utilities don't want to see that happen. We need to figure out how do we empower that customer so that they can control their energy destiny via their cell phones. And actually, if they have a storage system, an electric car, and a solar system on their roof, can they play in the energy market where if they're selling us power on peak when we need it, we can compensate them?
Speaking of Tesla, I would like to own one too. Are they on sale yet or they're still in production?
Oh, they have been on sale. They're pretty expensive. They have the Model S and the Model X.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need to be $60,000 to $100,000 out of pocket to drive a Tesla. But they're driving a new model now that's going to be around $30,000, which is going to, I believe, roll out next year if they don't have any delays. But Tesla right now is focusing on storage. They're building the Gigafactory where they predict that the cost of storage is going to dramatically decrease with the increased production that they're going to have in their Gigafactory. So they're a very exciting company to watch. And as you know, they just announced that they're merging with City Solar, the solar company. So we're going to have a very interesting player entering the market with a comprehensive set of services on generation, on storage, and on mobility.
Now, in the past, you've spoken about the importance of building out our energy storage capabilities to allow for easier integration of renewables. What sorts of storage are you currently using in California, and what do you see as the most promising storage technologies in the future?
We always need a variety of technologies and a variety of solutions. With renewables, it's important to make sure that we have a cross-section representation of technologies and not focus only on one. It would not be smart to just have wind or just have solar or just have hydro. You need to have a variety. The solar and the hydro balance very well. The wind and the hydro balance very well. The solar and the wind are usually when the sun shines the most, the wind is not blowing, and then at sunset the wind comes down, so there's certain complementarity there too. It's also regional as well. So first of all, being able to integrate those resources into the existing grid and being able to dispatch them, which means you have a good integrated grid, with a larger geographic footprint, so you can play the geographies. That is very, very important. Having a microgrid that incorporates all of your on-site distributed resources that's incorporated to the larger grid and allows you to island off in terms of stress or in terms of catastrophes or any kind of natural disasters is also a good backup solution to have as well, and it allows customers to participate. And then introducing storage in all of its varieties, from the very small instantaneous feedback for a few minutes, let's say the 10-minute increment where you're having that unpredictable growth or reduction in power use is very important. The 30-minute dispatch that allows you to say, okay, I know the sun's going down, I have about 30 minutes, what am I going to do in these 30 minutes and what resources am I going to dispatch? That is something that operators are comfortable with. The load shifting resource that is 2 hours or longer is also important, whether it's smaller or larger, so your pumped hydro comes into place. Large-scale pumped hydro is also a good solution. Of course, that has geographic limitations, and it's a large construction project, so that would be important to focus on as well. And all the new innovations that are coming down the pike, whether it's hydrogen or whether it's the smaller batteries, whether it's the flow batteries, or we even have a company that right now is proposing to run a train on a small hill up and down, acting very much like pumped hydro solution, except you don't need the water, you just have train cars and you can add more cars or fewer cars, and it actually provides storage capabilities as well. So ingenuity is in abundance, and we're seeing it emerge here in California, specifically because the California Public Utilities Commission took the step forward and said, we want to have 1,300 megawatts of storage adopted and installed throughout the utility service territory. So the three utilities had to go out and find projects for storage, excluding piped hydro. Pumped hydro was specifically excluded, that actually made sense. And you'd be surprised, they actually bought more than they were mandated to, because they found out that there were certain applications where even the very high-cost technologies made economic sense and could be dispatched at this time. So, again, creating the right atmosphere, creating the right regulations, creating the right pathway for innovation to start taking place into the marketplace is important, and it's happening.
Mm. You've spoken about the possibility of using electric vehicles as part of the grid storage solution. How would that work?
That's the vehicle-to-grid solution. Well, imagine you have thousands, millions, in fact, of electric vehicles throughout the state at charging stations, because you don't drive your car 100% of the time, right? Maybe you drive it 20, 30% of the time. Most of the other time, it's sitting idle. So if a vehicle owner has an agreement with the grid operator to say, okay, when the price of energy is zero, charge my car, and then I have free charging. And when the price of energy hits, let's say, 50 cents or higher, you can use my battery as a backup to the system. So you can call on my battery and discharge 20, 30, 50% of it, whatever you want. And you can send those signals via your cell phone. Those are technologies that actually are technologies worked on by students here at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, who have a very, very robust program for vehicle-to-grid integration. So all of a sudden, your car, that expensive electric vehicle that you've spent money for, is also a moneymaker for you. Because if you play it smart, you could be reimbursed for providing grid services by the grid operators. And all of those millions of batteries that are aggregated throughout the state can serve as an additional sink for excess power that's generated at certain times during the day, because that happens. And they can also be dispatched when there is a shortage and provide an additional flexibility to the grid that increases resiliency and stability.
Now, is there a business case to be made for transitioning to renewables, or are renewables still dependent on government subsidies?
Oh, I hate the word subsidies. Well, you know, actually, it is incentives. It's not subsidies. Renewables actually have, as far as I can see, with respect to solar and to wind at the large scale renewables, that train has left the station. They're now cost effective. They're competitive with other resources in terms of price. And having more experience integrating them into the grid has allowed them to become ever more present throughout the United States and indeed the world. And your lowest and fastest methodology to get power on the grid to remote communities very, very quickly. So we did not have subsidies for renewables. Technically, we had incentives because we had any kind of a monetary incentive for these programs was clearly identified as being reduced into the future. Whether it's the feed-in tariff in Europe, where they reduced it every year and you had a predictable reduction, or whether it's the programs here through the market mechanisms as well, and through the tax incentives. So it is an incentive program that has now gone down by over 80%, maybe even more. In many instances, it has been eliminated because the cost of the technology has come down. So I would say with respect to renewables, we had a very effective incentive program that allowed the technological cost to go down dramatically, and we don't need to subsidize it anymore like we need to subsidize fossil energy. The subsidies for fossil don't go away. Now, there you have true subsidies. For renewables, you have incentives. What we need to see happen now is on the storage side, the vehicle side, and the hydrogen side is very much a similar program with a set of incentives that allow the growth of the market and the reduction of the technological cost so we can incorporate them faster into the grid of the future and ensure high quality, good jobs for the young people who are in university today.
I understand you spent part of your early life in Tanzania and have continued to visit Africa since then. So you're familiar with many of our energy challenges, aren't you?
Well, yes, some of the energy challenges. I grew up in Tanzania, East Africa, from the age of about 9 to 15. So it was the best time.
Yeah. Do you think African countries, where we still have hundreds of millions of people without electricity, should be investing in new technologies, or which may not be entirely proven, or traditional energy solutions that we know work?
Well, define traditional energy solutions. A traditional energy system with an integrated grid and centralized fossil power plants takes decades to build, right? And it might be outdated by the time it's finished, and maybe you'll have a stranded asset, maybe you won't. On the other hand, a very robust renewable energy powered system with a good set of storage technologies on a microgrid level can be built in a matter of weeks and maybe a few months. And you can power the whole community independently and not have to wait for a large scale grid to reach that community. So African countries actually are fortunate in this sense that they can leapfrog technologies like the cellular technology, the wireless technology and telecommunications actually took place in Africa. And you don't need to be waiting for the wires to reach you in order to have communication. We can have wireless energy as well. And that, in my opinion, is the cheapest and the fastest way to bring energy, to bring education, to bring Doctors Without Borders over the internet and allow a community to be empowered, including and especially educating the children and the girls and making sure that they're prepared for the 21st century.
Yeah. Now, Angelina, on my last question, are there any examples you're familiar with of African countries making effective use of renewable energy?
You know, I was in Kenya a few years ago, and what surprised me was the abundance and the development of geothermal energy. We don't talk about geothermal a lot, but geothermal is also a resource where if you're lucky enough to have it, is something that would be useful and that can be done in order to harness that power. It provides 24/7 energy. So that was certainly something that Kenya Power Lighting Company was looking at. I know that they're also looking at solar. I don't know to what extent it has been incorporated as of late because they were having some billing issues. But I know that there are renewable energy programs in Tanzania and others, renewable energy programs springing throughout the continent. I don't know specifically how effective they have been, but I would love to see a program that empowers women and girls and make sure that the schools are powered with renewable energy and interconnected to solar schools around the world where children can check on the weather and see what a system in Germany is producing versus a system in South Africa, for instance, and compare the generation profiles and the benefits of why you would have that system and what else can be added, such as water pumping or water purification, because water is also an issue we need to be concerned about. And certainly water purification powered by renewable resources is a very, very possible solution. And that's something that we need to be looking at as well as we embark on this comprehensive carbon-free energy and hopefully water and transportation future that is before us. And it's exciting. I think it's fun. It provides for innovation and in creativity in areas that we thought traditionally were boring.
Angelina, before I let you go, I would like you to share with our listeners your contact details in case they want more information about what you do or in case they want to do research.
Well, they can certainly log onto renewables100.org. So just spell www.renewables with an S, the number 100.org. There's a lot of information over there. I guess the easiest email would be my last name, galipova@aol.com. Also, there's contact information on the renewables website, which is a.galipova@renewables100.org. So those are the contact information. And I'm happy to provide a phone number if somebody wants to call as well.
Well, go ahead. I do hope someone is going to find it useful and not abuse your phone number.
Well, that would be okay. It's 0735-3981.
Okay. And you say mostly students doing engineering are interested in renewable energy.
Well, yes, in terms of the practical aspects of it and the technological aspects of it. But there are students doing public service as well in terms of regulatory frameworks and who want to go into public service in the future. Students that are interested in law, the new legal structures are going to be very important. Students who are interested in accounting, because accounting for CO2 emissions in the sinks and being able to count carbon credits and price carbon credits and trade carbon credits, if we have a cap and trade system like we do in California, that provides accounting students with a future as well. So students of many disciplines certainly can benefit from being involved in renewables.
Angelina Galitova, thank you so much for being with us here on UNISA Radio.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Yes, it's Godfrey.
Oh, Godfrey, sorry.
No, it's okay. I know sometimes, Godfrey's such a new name. It's not that old.
It's a great name.
But nonetheless, thank you very much for joining us here on UNISA Radio.
Thank you.
And I do hope, I do hope you're going to enjoy your day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.